This podcast series is brought to you from the University of Winchester. We invite you to listen in as we talk with both academics and practitioners about their approaches to peace building and conflict transformation, discussing some of the most complex and pressing challenges we face in the world today.
My name is Anna King. I am a Professor of Religious Studies and Social Anthropology in the University of Winchester. I'm absolutely delighted to be talking today to Professor Jolyon Mitchell from the University of Edinburgh. He specialises in religious violence and peace building, with particular reference to the arts. We're going to be discussing peace building and the arts, which is a thought-provoking and eclectic collection of articles by authors from all over the world on the potential of the arts for peace building. So, welcome, Jolyon. Absolutely delighted to be talking to you. First question I would like to ask is that I know that this book emerged out of a series of workshops and collaborations, and I know that it's taken quite a long time. I wonder if you could explain the process and the vision from which this book has emerged.
This book drew together a number of different scholars, practitioners, artists, filmmakers, musicians, a whole range of different scholars. And it was actually a delight to work with such a wide range of both practitioners, peace builders, and academics. And what we loved about this was it wasn't just an academic conversation and it wasn't just a practitioner conversation. It was meant to be multilingual. And at its best, it did work like that. That's how it was. A series of seminars which were held both here in Scotland and in the USA. And between those two spaces, these seminars took probably about 3 or 4 years, and the book itself almost took about a decade to put together. But I'm pleased with that because actually it allowed a whole range of new insights to be added to the conversation. So you can see in the way the book's structured, it's structured around a number of different conversations. That might be one conversation around the role of the visual arts in peace building, another around the role of music in peace building, another on literature and peace building, another on film and peace building, and another on other issues that's related here. And I'm just turning over the book page on theatre and dance. And so we had, for example, in the theatre section, we had both actors, mime artists, dancers, as well as people who had used theatre storytelling in conflict, post-conflict, pre-conflict situations, such as Northern Uganda. And for me, I found an incredibly educative set of conversations, which one of the outcomes was this book, this editor book with a series of essays. We sadly had to leave out many essays, and actually it went into another volume as well, because we wanted to be quite rigorous about how we structured the book, because the book is obviously different from the conversations that took place here in Edinburgh and also in the States at the University of Notre Dame.
And would you say that you ended up with a sort of common vision of what the book should be? I mean, through your collaboration, did that process, you know, result in a coming together of minds?
Yes, to a point, but I think I wouldn't want to constrain the variety of different perspectives, voices. We were keen to hear different dialects, different languages, not literally, even though some people were sometimes speaking Spanish and so on, but actually we were keen not to try and constrain people's vision. You can see, for example, in the section on music, we have a number of very different perspectives on the role of the Baron Boyne Sage music on the West Bank, you know, the Palestinian Israeli music, where you have one scholar who's a musicologist and a very fine oud player, actually, Rachel Beckles Wilson, who's worked quite a lot on colonialism and music in Israel-Palestine, reflecting very critically on the East-West orchestra. And then another musician who is actually also a scholar and educationist, Catherine Jordan, coming from a different, more positive perspective. And I think for me, that's enriching because it's not saying that there's a party line to toe about this. These are issues to wrestle with and to reflect on critically, that one person's peace building may actually be another person's way of actually accentuating and creating more struggle and perhaps even more conflict.
It's funny that you chose that, actually, because I was also very impressed with those two papers in music, and particularly the very critical one on Daniel Barenboim, which sort of pointed out the dangers of people going into cultural situations which perhaps they're not aware of, and reflecting in this particular case the sort of classical tradition that was alien to the music of those around. So I'm amazed that you chose that, actually, because that is very clearly in my mind. So you're looking at the sort of differences that emerged, but you do actually, in your introduction, you do note recurring themes that occur throughout the chapters. And I was really interested in that, in the way that you're drawing attention to commonalities as well as differences. I wondered if you could walk us through some of the themes you found, possibly to make it easier for you, with reference to your own chapter on the visual arts. Whatever's easiest for you.
I found it fascinating, thank you, Anna, fascinating to reflect on the different themes that emerged. Now, obviously, these four themes that we identified in the introduction are by no means comprehensive of the variety of themes that emerged out of the 20-plus essays. But the first was around communication, and obviously communication is a huge category which covers an awful lot of things. But we were struck by sometimes the difficulties, the ambivalence around communication, that sometimes communication can actually be problematic. It can have a lot of injustice connected with it. There can be a lot of power differentials. You know, if you're a Hollywood filmmaker with a budget of 50 million, that's very different with someone on a mobile phone in a desert. Then the second was bearing witness, second recurring theme, and that emerged really again and again, of how artists can bear witness, not just to peace building, but also to conflict and to past hurt. And I suppose that for me was, again, very educative and fascinating to see how a musician might bear witness in a very different way to an artist. And I found that fascinating, looking at, for example, the work of two artists during and soon after the First World War, Paul Nash and Otto Dix. Paul Nash, an artist who struggled with portraying human form, so would actually often portray the devastation to the landscape. And often that could be like a visual metaphor for what happens to people's bodies. So you see unrelated, scarred landscape, which actually is almost like the torn bodies after a war. So that's very different from Otto Dix, the German artist, who portrays the lacerations, the war cripples, as is one of his famous paintings, and the devastation, not just to the landscape, but also to the human form in explicit form. So in other words, there you've got two very contrasting forms of bearing witness. Mm-hmm. The third recurring theme would be around empathy. Mm-hmm. I suppose how the arts allows us, invites us, encourages us to step into other people's worlds. What does it feel like to actually allow encourage your son to go and fight in the trenches and then after 4 weeks to be killed? And then as Katie Kollwitz, the well-known fine German artist, spent the same number of years as he lived, 18 years, trying to find the right artistic form, not just to bear witness, but also to express her heartbreak. And of course, she creates this extraordinary piece called Grieving Parents, which are these large separate sculptures, which are now in a cemetery in Belgium, if you like, almost apologizing to Peter, their son, as one leans down clutching her body, and the man also looks into the distance, and Peter's buried only a few feet away, really, along with hundreds, thousands of other young men. It's almost like one generation saying sorry to another for what's happened. So that's a form of communication, a form of bearing witness, and a form of empathy, because it invites us to step into the world of grief and of loss. And then I suppose a fourth area would be that of healing, how the arts can contribute, if it can, it doesn't always, but how it can contribute to healing. How can it actually heal in conflict situations? And so you have those four strands. I suppose if I was to reflect and just step back from those four strands of communication, bearing witness, empathy, and healing, I might go to another, which is the ambivalence of the arts. This is drawing on Scott Appleby's very well-known idea of the ambivalence of the sacred. I would actually push it a bit further and say, it's worth thinking about the ambivalence of the arts. In other words, the arts can at times incite violence as well as promote peace. And so one of the things that came out of this book was the ambivalence of the arts. We're not trying here to say the arts is like a magic wand which will bring peace automatically. Of course it won't. But it can do, and it can do in very extraordinary, unexpected ways. It can also add to the problems, as you see in a number of different essays in the book.
Thank you. And that actually leads very perfectly into the more critical question I'm going to ask you. And I hope you, it's a little bit longer than the other question. So this question, as you've just said, you echo Appleby's understanding of the art as ambivalent and also, in your own words, volatile. And here I'm going to quote what you say. The arts can set human communities on the road to death or the road to life. You write that the arts have been employed to legitimate unjust power, celebrating and promoting violence, and creating ethnic religious identities that result in structural violence. You also note that the role that the arts have played in sustaining peaceful and just societies is much less evident. I would like to challenge these views and say that the arts on the whole reflect the society around them, and that violent regimes often coerce people into producing art and literature that reflect their values, for example, Nazi Germany. So what I'm really saying is that the arts are not ambivalent. They're reflecting the multiplicity of society. So in a liberal and free society, artists, novelists, and dancers will critique and interrogate injustice and conflict where it exists in a way that, to my mind, privileges plus peace. In fact, the role of the arts, I'm saying, is very evident. In a totalitarian state, they may have to go underground. And I would like to bolster my argument by looking at COVID-19 in the world today and say that artists and creators have made a critical contribution to our well-being and to relative peace. I'm critiquing it's the idea that the arts are themselves ambivalent and saying in fact, you know, it's slightly more different. They reflect the hugely complex and interactive nature of the society around them, and possibly that they have less autonomy than you suggest.
I mean, I think that's a fair point, to a point, in that clearly the political, cultural, but particularly the political context, who pays the artists, who control the artists, will have a massive impact. And that's a very fair point on what is produced. And as you know, there's loads of work about the patrons and how that shapes the art and so on. And I suppose one of the things that I found intriguing about both the conversations that we had leading up to the publication of the book and the publication of the book was the way in which a number of practitioners demonstrated how the arts can subvert the political dominance.
I wasn't saying they couldn't at all. So please sort of continue. But no, I mean, they have a role in subverting. I think what I was trying to say was that you say that the role of the arts in peace building or moving towards peace is less evident than their role in, as you say here, legitimating celebrating and producing, promoting violence. I think it's that I was querying, and also whether ambivalent in the sense of Janus faced, on the one hand violence and on the other hand peace, is the correct way to understand the multi-intentioned outlook of artists and creative, creative singers, musicians. I mean, I'm thinking of, say, you know, the history of music. Wasn't it more the core piece, really, than war, for example? I mean, I know you get drums and military tattoos, but, you know, if we go back, it was that I was getting at.
So if I've heard you correctly, the point, there was a bit of dropout, so I just want to clarify.
Sorry, yeah.
No, don't apologise. I just didn't, that you're saying that the ambivalence, just the two-way, is too binary, and what you're suggesting is actually, in a way, what you have in the arts is a multiplicity of voices which reflects the cultural context, whatever the dominant form is, whether that's in North Korea, where you might be celebrating through forms of social realism, or it might be in liberal New York, or parts of liberal New York, celebrating diversity of voices. So is that fair to what you're saying? I think that's a fair point. I think the complexity there, and it might be a way of taking the book forward. And for us, the book was very much part of a conversation, ongoing conversation, in no way wanting to close anything down, but wanted to open up further conversations, because up to this point, there hasn't really been a book like this before in terms of trying to map out peace building in the arts. But I think in a way, the diversity of voices and diversity of approaches in the book actually does support your case very well. And it might be that that's something that needs to be drawn out further in future work, that actually looking at the multiplicity of voices, which isn't binary. And I think I take that. I think the picture that for me is probably my favorite picture in the book, not because of its artistic quality, but because of what it's saying about peace building, is actually Maurys Harron's Hands Across the Divide, which is in Ulster, in Derry. And it's two people who are stretching towards each other. Now, they are not holding hands. They're not embracing, as in some of the other pictures earlier in the book. There's not an embrace. They're actually stretching towards. So there is a sense in which, for me, captures the essence of what peace building is about. And the reality of peace building is that it is the move towards the other, which is very difficult sometimes both to represent but also to enact. And of course, in Northern Ireland at the moment, even though we are, 22 plus years since the Good Friday Agreement, there is still a sense in which these divided communities are moving towards each other, and sometimes moving away from each other as well. So you can see that the other hands are stretched outwards, you could say pointing away. So for me, that is one example of the complexity and difficulty of peace building, and how the arts doesn't necessarily answer all the questions. Now you might say, oh, well, hang on, surely that's too simple. And yes, it is too simple. The arts sometimes have to simplify in order to communicate, but you can be simple without being simplistic, because for me that picture isn't simplistic. It's just saying this is a divide, we are divided, it's a divided, fragmented community, in the same way in a number of different places around the globe. It's and you'll know number much better than I do, but the divisions are still there. But I think, just going back to your reflection on the nature of the arts, I think there's another piece that I've worked quite a bit on, and you've probably come across it, but in a way, again, metaphorically, it might resonate with what you're saying, in the project in Mozambique about the arms into art project, which takes weapons and turns them into, for example, a tree of life or a throne of weapons. Yes. Now, for me, what's striking about that piece of art is that it transforms weapons into art, but it also encapsulates a history of violence as well as of a hope for peace, but it does it through a whole range of different weapons. And so there you've got the multiplicity of weapons there, that it's not just one weapon, but it's a whole range of weapons that have come maybe from East Germany or from the Czech Republic or from the Soviet union, and these are brought, changed by the art, transformed into new forms. So what you have there then is art that is not just bearing witness, not just transforming violence, but potentially imagining hopeful futures as well. And notice there I use the word hopeful futures. I use plural, not singular, that it is hopeful futures. It's not a singular future, but the arts here is anticipating hopeful futures. I don't think I've done fully justice to your critical question, which I will go away and think about for the rest of the day.
Well, I'm very pleased and happy that you've taken it so seriously, actually, because I was wondering what to say. But can I say that one of your articles did actually make me think? And you were saying about moving together, and it made me go back to Levinas, actually, because he stresses alterity and otherness, radical otherness. And he talks about wisdom, philosophy as the wisdom of love rather than love of wisdom. And he argues that responsibility for the other is rooted within our subjective constitution. And I love that because it goes slightly against what you were saying about the arts and, you know, that they support a role of violence and so on. But I do believe that responsibility for the other is rooted within our subjective constitution. So you helped me think that through by reading that particular article. Right. Nothing I was marginally critical about, but generally supportive of. You talk about artists, and by artists, I mean all those people that you mention, musicians, novelists, and so on. You talk about them as training to build peace, to wage peace, is actually what you say. And throughout the book, there is much talk of the arts being tools for peace building. I'm not sure that I particularly like the word tools for peace building because it makes it seem too instrumental. But I do understand what you mean. I mean, are you suggesting that, you know, sort of musicians, novelists, sculptors go into conflict areas and bring people together through the arts and through working together? Is that the sort of thing you have in mind?
No, I think it's more complicated than that. I think that's a fair reading, but for me, the really interesting next move in the discussion on peace building the arts is to think about it in relation to the whole, what's often described as the three tracks in peace building. So it can, and it does, work at the grassroots level. There's lots of evidence to support that. But also to think about it, how it works at the mid-level, perhaps with the mayors or the religious leaders or the managers, and to think about where it's working there, if it does, if it works there. And then finally, to think about how it might even work in track one. Mm. In other words, the elite conversations. There is some evidence that in some conversations that actually bringing that might be a musician or a poet or a storyteller into those complex negotiations around the table, that actually can add not just value, but insight and new ways of discussing peace treaties in that level as well. So for me, the next stage of the discussion, I think, would be worth us, not just here, but in terms of researchers and practitioners, thinking about how the arts can work at all of those three levels.
I think that's incredibly interesting. Just to draw on my own experience for a bit, as you may know, in Myanmar, we worked at the international level, the national level, and the conflict areas. And I found that the relationships connecting all those levels across created a platform for many different kinds of people to come together in safety to, first of all, critique the government and some of the atrocities that were taking place. But we also used music and theatre and art in that project. And I thought that was very remarkably successful. Not exchanging theological ideas, but actually acting, singing, dancing, being wells together, but also operating at the level of the UN and also rational government. I think I've only got one more question because I think the time is, I'm going to have run out of time. But I think in the end, last question would be, if you could suggest ways in which the book, I know it's original, it's doing something very important, but advances the theory of conflict and peace studies. You know, how do you, you were talking about Appleby earlier. I noticed in the book that the theorists most often referred to are Scott Appleby, Jean-Paul Lederach, and Levinas, much less so. Can you explain to me if you think that there is, you have got a theoretical perspective or approach which actually contributes to the whole of peace studies?
Yes, I think that's a very fair question, and we intentionally didn't want to make it a theory heavy book, because we thought that in a way the strength of the conversations was rooted in practical action, academics in conversation and peace builders in conversation with artists as well. So that was the second thing to observe is that actually Jean-Paul Lederach and Scott Appleby were part of the conversation. So they were there in the conversations at a number of times, and Scott was both in the States and in the UK as well. So and also because they're significantly there in literature, you could argue that Jean-Paul Lederach's work on the moral imagination and then more recently on music with his daughter, that's been very enriching to the discussions around peace building and the arts. In terms of a theory, I do think you're right. I'm really glad you've reflected on Levinas. And in a way, there's so much more that could be discussed in relation to Levinas. And just very briefly on that, I think given the emphasis at the moment on covering faces and how we are masking our faces, one of the things you could suggest is that there's a revelatory quality in the arts that may actually take masks off in a way that Levinas might approve of, in that he celebrates, of course, the challenge of the naked face that actually says to the other that, you know, that I am here, I am vulnerable, and you know, that this face here appeals to you in different ways that may actually lead towards peace. Now, that's a terrible simplification of Levinas' more complex theory. But I suppose just to go on a bit further to think about, I think there is more theoretical work to be done. And it will be interesting to think about upon what foundations would this, a theory of peace building in the arts, where would those foundations go? And I suppose a number of foundations might spring to mind. One might be, as you were talking about Levinas and the thought about both the face and the other. Another might be around thinking about bearing witness. There's a theorist, a very interesting theorist called John Durham Peters, who's actually, he's actually a very fine communication scholar who talks extensively about different kinds of bearing witness. So there is more work to be done, I think, about how do you bear witness? What are the theories that work on that? What part is that within peace building? I suppose another would be to think about the role of religious peace building. I know this is an area you've worked in extensively, to think about what is the relationship between theories of religious peace building and theories around peace building and the arts. Because there are different strands there that weave together. And you can actually see it in Scott Appleby's very evocative afterword on evoking the Yarra, which is reflecting on how you might have an artist who could be really problematic in life, but actually still be a genius artistically. Mm. And I think there's something very rich about that. You could raise all sorts of questions about various authors' problematic lives, Picasso's difficult engagements with his partners and so on. Does that invalidate their works? Does that invalidate, for example, Guernica because of the way in which Picasso related to women in his life? Or does it actually, do we have to make a distinction? Now you could say, well, hang on, Julian, look, what you're doing here is you're moving swiftly away from theory into practice. And actually I am doing that intentionally because I really believe passionately in this subject that it's vital that the theory and practice work hand in hand. And I suppose you'll find that there is a light touch approach to theory here, but it is there in a number of different essays. Hal Cubberston, for example, who in his essay on peace building and the performing arts, draws on theories around collaboration. Or you can see it in, for example, Francis Clemson's book on theories around time, drama, and peace building. I use those two examples, but there are, in other words, a number of different theorists that are beneath the surface in this book. I don't think there's a singular theory yet. I think probably the closest we've got is probably in John-Paul Lederach's on the moral imagination and the arts. You may have other thoughts, but I think it's an area that deserves and merits further work. But that's exciting because I'm hoping that this volume will generate more discussion, more scholarship, and a richer practice around the world.
Well, that might be a good place to end. I mean, I have lots more questions, but that was a very fine end to that. So perhaps I ought to thank you very much and say how much I've enjoyed it.
Well, thank you so much for engaging with the book so thoughtfully, and I really enjoyed our conversation as well. So it's been great to hear your perspective. So thank you, Anna.